Hey there, I'm your host, Paul. A few points of context ahead of today's show. First, thank you for listening. I realize there's a lot of material out there, and I'm grateful that you'd spend your time with us. Second, if you want to get a sense of my background and the team that makes this happen, go to paulpodolsky.com. And lastly, if you like the material, please submit a review on Apple Podcasts. Those reviews are the currency of the modern creator economy. The show's been downloaded tens of thousands of times, yet less than 1% of listeners leave a review. And the same, by the way, goes for the essays about politics and money on Substack, and also the books, Master Minion and Raising a Thief, and the book that's going to be out next year, Uncomfortable Truths About Money. And with that, let's jump in. So my guest today is Scott Nelson, who is a professor and an expert on many things, but among them, grain, which is what we'll be talking about today. So welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
Thanks so much, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
I always feel awkward with that title, having a professor on, because clearly you are teaching this stuff in school. But let me put it this way. Most people don't know this stuff in school. So for those people who haven't heard of you, why don't you give a little bit of a background about who you are and why you're so curious, why you're curious enough about grain to write a book about it, and then we'll turn to the relevance to today's world.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. My way into history was peculiar. I was a network engineer, computer hacker kind of person for a while, and was interested mostly fixed networks for very large Fortune 100 companies when I was going through graduate school, and so thought about the world in terms of networks, in terms of trade, in terms of how things move, almost what you call civil logistics, so logistics but not connected with war. And when I became interested in history, I was interested in the 19th century, I was interested in the 1800s, but my framework for looking at it was largely about how things move around in the world. So how it is that carbon, you know, for example, travels around the world, what effects it has, the changes in geopolitics that follow from the movement of those commodities, but primarily the commodities that I'm primarily interested in are food commodities. And I became interested in how empires worked. And I have been noodling around for about 25 years with this question of the Panic of 1873, understanding its origin. And about after writing a bunch of articles and books about this, I discovered that I was inadvertently plagiarizing a communist from Belarus who I'd never heard of before. And who was saying the same thing. They're saying that, you know, if you understand this 1873 panic, you understand how the United States becomes a world power. You understand how Europe falls apart. You understand the instability of the Russian Empire and things like that. And so finding this guy, my man crush, an immensely obese grain trader from Odessa, who is also a communist, he became the person, just kind of understanding his world became a fascination of mine. And then I could finally see how to tell a story of the kind of international distribution of grain, partly through his eyes. He put on bigger spectacles, I suppose, for me than I had before.
So it's, I think one of the tricky things about the modern world is that many people are several step removed from the core fundamental cause-effect drivers that really create civility. And food is one of them.
Right.
And so, you know, very few people are involved in agriculture. They go to the store and it's always there. Where it comes from is a little bit of a mystery. But wheat is fundamental to keeping 8 billion people alive. And there's very few places in the world that have excess supplies of that.
Right.
And Russia and Ukraine is one of them, which relates to this war that we're in. And the United States is another, but so is Europe, Australia, Argentina, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So talk about the role of wheat in sort of undergirding civility, and then how does it move around the world?
So part of what I talk about is kind of how empires build themselves on using wheat, right? So if we think about the Roman Empire, we think about the Greek empires before that, even empires that we don't really have a name for because they're long gone, have depended in part on the consolidation of wheat into large warehouses, predecessors of banks, and ensuring that the enslaved people who grew the wheat were kind of dependent on this empire. And so we've got the ancient empires that thrive on wheat and the hold on wheat. If you go to Rome, you know, just a few miles away are what are called the aurea, which is the massive grain silos that make the Roman Empire possible. And so I talk about that kind of in the ancient world. And then around the 1790s, following the discovery of the physiocrats, who are kind of interested in Chinese, how the Chinese empire works, we see this new way of thinking about wheat. Rather than consolidating and bringing wheat into the center of an empire to hold it together, the physiocrats say, well, the first thing you need to do is not tax farmers. You need to let farmers do whatever they do. Tax everyone else. Tax landlords, tax manufacturers, tax traders, but do not tax the farmers. And secondly, if you have excess wheat, if you're an empire, you should sell it to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And so there are two empires that take that very strongly to heart. One of them is the United States, and the other one is the Russian Empire under Catherine the Great. And both of them become wheat expelling empires. So empires that gather wheat together, but then sell it to the rest of the world. And that makes them both world powers. Russia first, Russia becomes a world spanning empire on the basis of the grain it sells out of Ukraine, out of the Black Sea. And then the United States finally catches up in the 1860s, connected to a bunch of other technological changes that I talk about. And the United States becomes a world empire, really not because of its manufacturing, not because of its workers, not because of immigration, but really because of its food, because it has a tremendous amount of food that it can sell to the rest of the world.
So I want to go into a little bit of the framework for the different pieces that are interrelated to make the food, because it's not just the food, it's a whole series of other related structures. But before we get there, one thing I'm not clear at all in my study is, what the heck was leading Catherine the Great to go so far afield? Because if you think about it back then, like what was then the Black Sea, mm-hmm. and then Catherine the Great is in St. Petersburg, this is in the 18th century. These are long distances to travel, and it's pretty bold idea. And she's a pretty bold person, but pretty bold idea to be like, no, we need to get all these people that for thousands of years have been occupied by other, you know, the Cossacks and the Greeks and the blah, 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 going back and different tribes and warring. And then it was on the edge of the Polish Empire. Like, it's a pretty bold, like the U.S., I get it. It was basically, as the territory expands, it's a really good place for growing. But for her, it is a stretch. It's almost like if the idea to create the wheat empire first occurred in like Vancouver, and then you were like, okay, let's go expand this whole area. They're not going to like us, but they'll come to deal with – like what was motivating her?
Right. That's a great question. So Russia really, you know, going back to Peter the Great, even before then, really sees their future along the Black Sea. We have, you know, St. Petersburg and Moscow, but the dream for centuries really is to occupy the center of the world as they see it. And the center of the world is Istanbul, or initially Byzantium, and then Constantinople, and then Istanbul. That's the center of the world. That's where trade happens. And so heading as close as you can to Constantinople, Istanbul is the dream if you want to create an empire. So a czar is Caesar, right? And so the dream was that the czar would become the Caesar of a new Rome, and that new Rome would be centered on the Black Sea, just as Byzantium had been for 1,000 years. So part of it is just this very old idea that's crucial to the Russians. But Catherine is also jealous of the Poles. And the Poles have figured out that they can more or less enslave Ukrainian farmers to grow wheat and then sell it north on the North Sea. And so that's what feeds, you know, in the 13th and the 14th and 15th century, that's what feeds people, particularly in periods of starvation from the north, on the North Sea. And she wants to get that land from the Poles and get the land from the Turks and build down.
But at that point, wasn't the Polish Empire like, it's sort of like what's now Ukraine, like there's a big chunk of it that's part of the Polish Empire that's over. And then there's this other section here that's sort of controlled by a group that is rebelling against the Polish Empire.
Right.
More of the Cossacks. But it's sort of, it's still a bold thing to incorporate them all. And I guess the answer is that they have better military technology. There's not the ability to defend themselves, because the Ukrainian, what we now consider the Ukrainians, has already been there for hundreds of years before all this happened.
No military technology, but as financial technology, right? And so it's understanding that you can offer to pay in the future for grain that's delivered today with the assignat. Not to get too into the weeds, but these bills of exchange and the assignat and these other kind of financial instruments that allow the Russian Empire, particularly under Catherine, to figure out how they can, wheat prices are too low in Ukraine because, you know, they're effectively blocked by the Ottoman Empire. And so if you offer a higher price, but paid in the future to farmers, they will sell you that grain in an instant. And then you can feed your soldiers. 95 to 98% of all of the things that are transported to soldiers on the front line are food by weight.
Okay, I got it. So this segues nicely into the framework. So to have the wheat be powerful, it's not only that you have to have the substance, but you really have to have a whole architecture around it.
That's right.
And the framework is you need to have transportation, including ideally deep water ports, but also rail, et cetera.
Right.
You need to have an end market that you can sell it into. You need to have credit facilities, because there's a gap between the production of it and then the selling of it. And if that's basically what a futures market is, which now people think about, like, what is a stock future? But the roots of it is literally trying to solve this problem with cotton and wheat. Mm-hmm. And then you have to have some sort of ability to transact in currencies to make this. You need to have globally convertible currencies. And so in this setup, it seems like the 19th century can be explained a little bit of the fact that the U.S. did very, very well at having that infrastructure. In fact, better than Russia. Mm-hmm. And B, if you then fast forward to today's conflict, to some degree, it is, you can look at it in terms of the state, the violation of sovereignty and stuff like that. But some degree, it's just a reversion to that same tendency, like we want to control these critically important areas of the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Russia has Novorossiysk, which is its one deep water port in on the Black Sea, or usable deep water port for grain. It's on the eastern side of the Black Sea. When it takes Crimea, it gets four more. When it takes the Donbass, it gets six more. So this is part of it is, you know, the Donbass is a valuable region. Crimea is a valuable region. But part of it all is also deep water ports, which you can put Panamax ships on and pour hundreds of thousands of tons of grain to sell to the rest of the world. The U.S., Russia is the number one wheat exporter in the world. Russia understands that oil has got a limited shelf life, you know, over the 100-year period. And wheat is suddenly, again, just like in the 19th century, just like in all the centuries before the 19th century, the key commodity to global geopolitical commodity.
Right. Though I would say that the difference, what's interesting is if you look at this conflict, in part because of the strength of that infrastructure. Yes, wheat prices exploded when it happened, but they probably plummeted back down. And it had to do with the fact, I'm guessing, some of it just has to do with crops and productivity of the rest of the world. But it's also that a little bit like the natural gas, you could create another infrastructure very quickly that was able to feed the, in other words, who the cities are that are dependent on Russian wheat seems to have shifted since the 19th century, less Europe, more North Africa.
Yes, although if you look at Byzantium, look at the Byzantine Empire,
yep.
That's North Africa and, you know, down the Horn of Africa. And those are places that are also, they're still, you know, 1,000 years later getting their grain from the Black Sea. So the old Byzantine Empire did collect grain into Istanbul or Constantinople then and transport it to these coastal ports and things like that. So there is this kind of 1,000-year, 2,000-year-old almost flow of grain from that. Like you say, it's the Goldilocks zone, right? Deep ports, flat plains, water that runs off from the mountains, that's Ukraine, or much of Ukraine. And it's the kind of perfect place for growing grain and then delivering.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
And has Putin spoken, like if Putin has had a lot of fantastical sort of visions of what the historic, a lot of it based on terrible history, but I haven't seen him speak about grain at all. Have you seen him say anything?
It's in his dissertation. His dissertation.
His stolen dissertation.
His plagiarized dissertation. Yeah, very likely purchased dissertation. But, you know, it was about
what his name's on it.
Right. But it was about the agro-industrial complex. Right. It was about how it is that you use agriculture.
I thought it was about raw materials. I didn't know it was specifically on agriculture.
Yeah. In fact, he uses this Marxist term, agro-industrial complex, which comes from geographers in the 1960s and 1970s to say, how is it that this agro-industrial complex is a term that was used by Marxist geographers in the 1960s and 1970s to say that the United States became a great power by providing wheat, but having enough food to create cities, which would then have factories. So that's different from my argument, but that's Putin's world in a way. Is if he at least read it,
right,
the dissertation that he allegedly wrote. So it's geopolitical resources, but food is being a crucial one. And that's the really Putin from 2000 forward is, you know, what they call food security, which means totally different from what we mean by food security. What they mean by food security is to make sure the food is produced in Russia and is cheap enough so that they don't have to buy food from elsewhere. And that's been
But also gives them a huge amount of influence globally.
Yeah.
To be able to provide that. It's not in your book, but I don't know whether you've looked at it, how much these pathways shift due to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Ukraine over the summer, I met with one guy who was an ag expert, and he said to me, which was interesting, is that what's the fertile belt in Ukraine? The whole thing has moved north. I don't know by how much, but he said the whole thing has moved north about so. How much does this shift, given that globally in terms of exports? Do you have any notion?
It's a good question. There is some. Right now there is grain going through Poland to the North Sea, but it's very expensive to get it that way. Russia, in the 2000s, Russia was talking about developing deep water ports in the north in these places that had previously been covered with ice. It turns out they keep exploding. Because when you get these weird cloud effects, methane gas comes from the ice melting. You've got floating methane gas in these deep water, and then they just blow up. Somebody lights a cigarette, and so they tried a couple of times to make these deep water ports further north, which would, it's the kind of logical move. But methane is the killer, really, of that plan. But even in the 21st century, building what the Ukrainians called Chorny Shtoki, the black paths. Those are historical, those are ancient, those are prehistoric, actually, you know, these traveling routes. And the amount of investment that you need to reroute them is insane. So that the Kerch Straits, for example, the road that Putin builds over the Kerch Straits connecting Russia to Crimea after the annexation of Crimea cost $1.5 billion, right? And that is a perfect target because it's a very narrow route by which Russian grain gets out to the rest of the world. So
this infrastructure, the food, the transport, the markets, et cetera, it's very fragile. And one of the contentions you make in the book is that really it's the grain stays there and the roots stay there. The empires tried to organize themselves around, it's sort of like that is the nuclear power in a way, this ability to produce extra food.
Uh-huh.
And then the empires are trying to arrange themselves around it. And then it's getting the balance of all those factors right, which they frequently get wrong.
Right.
And it's incredibly complicated to get that balance right. And of course, the Soviet Union is a classic example of just the pendulum swimming way too far over here, destroying the whole financial infrastructure. And it's, you know, if you look at Russia today, it's interesting. They should have a thriving futures market, but they don't. In part because their financial systems are so primitive. So describe, like, if you look at it from that lens, how do you – it's almost like the Ukraine conflict. Another vantage on it is it's two different empires. There's sort of a European Union empire that is one way of looking at the world, and there's a Russian empire that's another way of looking at the world. And literally the center point of the conflict is around these fertile areas where the grain is.
Yes.
And so in your mind, how does this net out? Because Russia, you know, it's in their backyard and they have this aggression, but also – the sanctions and cutting them off from these financial worlds and then, you know, using weapons to bomb their ports. It seems like a very sketchy proposition right now to regain that if you're sort of seen as a pariah state.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of it, I think, is that Ukraine is, even when it's not at war, is a threat to Russia's power, financial power around the world. Like, it's a number one wheat exporter. But if you look at Ukraine's grain exports from 2008 to 2023, it's like this, because they're much closer to the deep waters, much cheaper for them to grow the wheat there, and then wheat and corn and soybeans and other things.
And also a lot of modernizing reform that's happened there in a less corrupt Zelensky type of world type of
absolutely,
thing.
Absolutely. Not 100 million acres owned by a few families in Russia, which is a lot of the grain that's produced in Russia is produced by these vast combines of, which are heavily subsidized and increasingly unstable. So the Ukrainian system, which is, 1,000-acre farms with new technology that's imported, it's, over the long term, Ukraine was not going to totally dwarf Russian grain exports, but would absolutely have cut into it. And probably once you get to something like less than 20% of the grain that's exported in the world, then you're not a price maker anymore. And that's that's hugely important, I think, for Russia.
Do you have a view on this? Like in this ancient struggle, in your book, you talk about the amount of times that Russia has attacked Turkey and the amount of wars that have been held. It's like it happens again and again and again, you have this key thing that different people want. When you look at these two empires crashing into one another, for simplification called East versus West, and you look at it against the backdrop of a history, do you have a feeling of which one do you think is likely to be successful?
So as a historian, I hate to make predictions about tomorrow, but
You're on a podcast. That's what's so fun.
Right? But I would say, 100 years from now, if you were going to look at the most powerful European state, it wouldn't be France. It wouldn't be Italy. It wouldn't be Germany. It would be Ukraine. Ukraine is that crucial, that powerful, that significant in terms of food production. As food prices go up relative to oil and other energy prices, it becomes a more critical resource, a resource that needs to be, and there's also lithium. There's an amazing amount of materials, untapped materials in Donbass and places like that would make Ukraine a perfect, but you would need a financial infrastructure, but I would guess that Ukraine would be better at pulling that off than Russia has been, certainly. So in a very, very long-term sense, Russia was built on Ukraine. All of Russia's wealth is 60% of its foreign exchange came from Ukraine. The rest of it came from Russia just north of Ukraine. It's where the wealth is. If you look at the richest people in the Russian Empire, right? There's some in St. Petersburg, there's some in Moscow, and all the rest are on the edge of the Black Sea. Right. That's where the wealthiest part of the world of the Russian Empire, just in terms of. And so that's where the resources are going to gather, because that's where the carbon is.
And it's also probably one of the most lethal parts of the world in the last 200 years in terms of amount of people murdered there, killed in conflict, et cetera. So it wasn't only the Russians, it was the Nazis and different, and it just goes back and back and back.
Right.
And the Turks and the Russians and before that. So it seems like
time of troubles in the 1600s. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like that notion, I would say, in U.S. foreign policy, that's what the stakes are. They're like, oh, we're fighting for democracy and human rights and stuff like that. The idea that you're fighting for basic structural food security, I don't think that's entered the dialogue.
And it's if we're talking about American interest, the extent to which there's chaos there actually benefits the United States. Farmers are doing better when there's chaos in Ukraine. But that's not been the conversation. I think rightly so. But if you were going to take it just narrowly in terms of self-interest, it doesn't really work. I do think that there is this sort of democracy issue. There is this sort of, and a sense that this is a geopolitical, that the drive to Istanbul is serious. Putin will not stop on the Black Sea. If he got the Donbass, he would go back again and taking big chunks out of the North Sea. And then ultimately, the dream of all the czars before was to capture Istanbul and call it Tsargrad.
Which means that Erdogan's very non-aligned status is incredibly cagey. Like he's, he helps the Ukrainians someplace and helps the Russians other. It's sort of like, I got no idea what this outcome is, but he probably, a lot of these guys know history pretty well.
Right.
And is probably trying to, and then if Ukraine loses, he'll probably align himself with NATO in seconds, because more tightly than they already, they're a member than they have, because the risk of Russia attacking goes up massively.
Right. I think allowing the Bayraktar to be, those Bayraktar missiles to be developed in Ukraine is telling that that's,
Say more about that.
Bayraktar are the really powerful missiles that are guided, that were used against tanks early on in the war. There's a song, a Ukrainian song called Bayraktar, which is about the power of these Ukrainian missiles and these Turkish missiles that were bought by Ukraine. And now Ukraine has licensed the production of Bayraktar in Ukraine. So, which it never had previously done. So, recognizing that this is a great power struggle in which they can, you know, Erdogan can get something out of both sides is important. But if things tip too much in the direction of Russia, I think you're right. Erdogan sees that he needs Europe to protect him.
And it also makes sense. I mean, when you're describing it this way, it also makes sense that it makes more sense to me China's alignment with Russia, because massive population, though shrinking, but commodity, people rich, commodity poor, and having reliable stores of energy, obviously, but of wheat as well, would be strategically, and I would imagine, Xi's interest.
That's a strange thing that puzzled me when the book was just coming out. There was all this, the Chinese translation took place almost instantly.
Fascinating.
The Japanese translation very, very quickly. And so for them, this is, you know, struggles in empires over food is not just Xi Jinping. You know, he went through a famine himself, understands the importance, the significance of food.
A man-made one, but still.
Yeah. But
he understands hunger, which is, if you haven't experienced it, it seems distant. And then once you have, it changes everything.
Right. Yeah, the book's been translated into eight languages, but the places where it was translated first, and even before this conflict started, was, you know, China and Japan and places like that, where they understand that elemental conflicts over food are, and so it's, you know, the Anglo-American way of telling the story about geopolitics tends not to be a whole lot about food.
It's not about food or military history that much, but both those things make a lot more sense when you look at it in the sense. I mean, I couldn't help thinking about your book about why naval power is so important too, because that's the thing that allows you to, the thing that allows Europe and this whole, the U.S. to exert its power is the ability to protect the sea lanes to get the grain to other places of the world and natural gas as well. So just segueing from that to what was your diagnosis of the 1873 panic after, I mean, you go into some of the book, but it's a lot of people have studied, you know, I've been through, traded through a lot of crises. And certainly there'll been a lot of books around the Great Depression. The 1873 thing is more distant in many people's mind, but describe it.
So I became interested in it a very long time ago, 1985, when I was writing a terrible master's thesis about the production of iron and steel. And the Russian explanation is different from the American explanation, which is different from the, you know, if you American historians tell one story, Russian historians tell another story, German historians tell another story. And they're all contradictory. They have something to do with, you know, is it a real estate boom? Is it speculation? And when I was reading these railroad directors' conversations with each other, private conversations, and reading the railroad newspapers, and they said it's all about grain. It's all about cheap grain, and the routes are changing, and this is destroying old merchant networks. And
massive U.S. production, low prices, capital calls, liquidity crisis?
Yes. So 68 to 72 wheat price, 1868 to 1872, wheat prices drop something like 40%, and they never go back up after that. So it's the biggest change in the price of food ever, I think.
Mostly due to the efficiency of U.S. production of the railways and getting it to market.
Right. And they're willing to sell grain at a loss, effectively, to start, you know, building these markets up.
Financed in part by banks, but in part by sort of railroad entities themselves doing some of the financing.
Exactly. The railroads themselves are creating these networks, and because it keeps the grain flowing on the network, on the railroad, if you can, with a loss leader of selling the grain in Europe and things like that. And so that brings down commodity prices, which brings down other prices. And then you've got a debt default spiral where, you know, it's because a deflation spiral where it's harder and harder to pay off those debts because money buys more and more over time.
You get cash hoarding, and it's just a withdrawal of liquidity, and it feeds on itself.
Exactly, cash hoarding. And so that story was one I wanted to tell, but I kind of told it in another book, Nation of Deadbeats, and a few other books in the past. Putting the geopolitical behind it was the job of Oceans of Grain to really get a sense of what the significance of this sort of grain story is to these major financial panics. I wrote a book called Nation of Deadbeats, which is about other commodities 1873, 1819, 1857, the other major financial panics.
Oh, my listeners are going to love this. I think there's a bunch of readers. So then if you look at today, I guess last a few questions for me. A, you know, in the past when you've seen really violent swings in the pathways, they do sometimes lead to global conflict. We clearly have a hot war. There's other hot wars on the horizon, Taiwan, but you could imagine, it's not difficult to imagine things. Once you start a war, they can spin out of control. That's one question. And then when I think about your thing, cash hoarding, et cetera, like I want the podcast to last, so I don't want to talk too much about current, you know, very, very current. But right now you see central bank policy all over the world really designed to get you to hoard cash. I think about that their battle to inflation is to make interest rates on cash so high, sort of sucking money.
I see. Right. That makes sense.
Anyways, both those topics, if you have any thoughts.
I mean, I do worry. I was very worried just about a month ago when the accord that allowed grain to come out of the Black Sea, which had been brokered by the UN and by Erdogan, this humanitarian corridor that allowed grain to flow out. That ended, and then a lot of Ukrainian grain started to flow along the Danube, and where it was safe, you know, right next to Romania. But Romania is a NATO power, though, and Russia started bombing ships and getting on ships and threatening ships, and that to me was a terrifying thing, because once you start firing on a NATO power, then we're talking about global war. And that there's no way that that ends without,
with grain being the spark.
Right. There's no way that that ends without global war. And so, you know, we look at World War One, look at World War Two. There are often unforeseen circumstances in which crossing a border, which is, you know, can be explained one way or another, ends up just spiraling out of control into conflict.
And you say in your book here, The Oceans of Grain, that in a way, Russia, if you look at it from the grain perspective, Russia sort of not quite started, but was like a primary belligerent in World War One related to grain insecurity and
exactly
alliances that would close off the Bosphorus.
The Crimean War, which was maybe World War Zero or something like that, was a similar thing where the Russians close off the Bosphorus and France and Great Britain say, no way, you know, you don't close off the Bosphorus. And that leads those allies to defeat Russia in the Crimean War. So, yeah, so I think we were closer to World War III and global catastrophe about 3 weeks ago when there was firing.
That's pretty close.
On the Danube. And so I do worry that there are plenty of opportunities for this to spiral into a direct conflict between NATO. And I hope that there are backdoor channels between Russia and NATO that are going to prevent that from happening, because it does worry me. I believe Ukraine has the right to, absolutely has the right to reclaim its territory, but I also worry about this spilling into world war.
And grain is such a useful framework that's why it's such a good book for viewing what's there. And then this is a little bit of a jump to a different topic, but the current monetary policy relative to panics, do you see any connection there, or does it seem like a spurious, seems spurious to you?
I
not
do think
where it is right now, but where it's going.
Well, I mean, you know, we have been living in a world in which interest rates were unbelievably low for a very long time, like insanely low. And there were good explanations for it. First, it was the 2008 crisis, and then it was COVID. That leads money to leak into all sorts of other places rather than banking. And that can be dangerous and weird, right? And so you can get a whole bunch of money went into the stock market, some of it for, you know, kind of spurious, and a bunch of it went into NFTs and crypto and all these other sorts of things. So when you have unbelievably low rates, banks are less safe places, seem less attractive for people putting their money in. And then you get these crazy channels for investment. And we're seeing those channels start to close down, NFTs and crypto and
it's
things like that.
It's just a question of how fast it goes.
Yeah, right. So I do think So I don't think we're yet at the point where my grandmother was, where she wouldn't trust putting money in a bank and kept dollar bills in a sock underneath the bed. You know, that was the world that she raised by her grandparents who went through the panic of 1873. Yep. That was her, you know, you never trust banks. So I think nobody is yet at that stage of hoarding so much that it's potentially
self-reinforcing in that way.
Self-enforcing or a deflationary spiral or something like that. I do think that the Federal Reserve, for better or for worse, is better at measuring deflation and inflation than it has been in the past. I'm glad that it's not using the gold standard and things like that the way it was in the 70s and 80s. So I'm a little more confident that there are valves that can be released in this regard. That's a long conversation that is kind of outside of the realm of the
book.
Well,
it's a good framing of it to put it into perspective what that gap is. So the podcast is called Things I Didn't Learn in School. So writing this research on oceans of grain, was there any, I mean, again, a little bit tough with the professor because it's all school, but was there anything here that really leaped off you when you were doing this great research that was like, holy mackerel, that's a new idea. I've never had understood that before.
Some of it was finding other people like Sean McMeekin and others who gave an account for World War I that was much more Russia-centered. And I was, you know, our framework for understanding World War I is basically it's the Germans' fault. And thinking about it as the Russians' fault actually really changes a lot about how you think about this. And it makes
it
Russian
really does. Sense. I thought that was one of the most provocative ideas in the book.
And so that's Sean McMeekin, you know, who reads whose Russian is better than mine and has worked in archives. But I think also, you know, think about the Russian Revolution as somehow having a single person who understands the movement of grain, being able to bring about a revolution. That was shocking to me. Also that he understood that Gallipoli was going to be the key place where the conflict was going to turn was also shocking to me. Like, you know, 4 or 5 years before, he says the war is going to be in the Balkans. The conflict is going to take place in Istanbul. The only way Istanbul can save itself is to build artillery along the Bosphorus. He's absolutely right. So it was uncanny how well this communist, crazy communist, multimillionaire
grain trader around the world.
Figures things out. And the Nazis say it's the Jewish communists, the millionaire Jewish communists that are responsible for World War I or, you know, and for German problems and things like that. And there's really only one. So the conspiracy theory about, you know, Jews and World War I, that's absolutely insane. But there's always a little grain of something there. And part of that is this guy who says the Russian Empire has to fail and this is the way to do it. And the fact that it succeeded, he hated the Soviet Union, but he liked the collapse of the Russian Empire. And to think that just a few people like that can turn the course of history it's mind-boggling. And it's not the way that historians think. Like I tend to think everything's about commodities, everything's about, you know, structure, everything is about, you know, finance and where the commerce is. And then this is somebody who sort of digs his finger around this, sees the same things and gives it a push.
Super helpful. Thank you for making time.
Oh, thank you. It's great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.